From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
And a very warm welcome aboard the pirate ship at the Reeve Gauche and to the Captain's Table podcast, brought to you by Are You Not Entertained and our great friends at Loch Lomond Whiskies. I'm Giles Morgan. I'm not actually a captain, or indeed a pirate, but a vague ancestor of my family, Captain Henry Morgan, actually was one, and his family all came from Wales as well. For 30 years, I have been lucky enough to travel all over the world as a boring old marketing suit in the sports industry, which included having arguably the best job in the world as head of sponsorship at HSBC. Along that journey, I got to rub shoulders with the good, the bad, and the ugly from the world of sport. And having ditched the pinstripe suit for breeches and the red waistcoat and cutlass that befits a pirate captain, I set out to create this podcast where every fortnight I simply ask my special guests from the world of sport to share their own personal memories of being a sports fan and how that passion has affected and shaped their lives. And hoy there, my hearties, and a very happy new year and a warm welcome back on board my pirate ship, the Reeve Gauche, and for another episode of the Captain's Table.
I'm the captain.
My first guest of the new year is a golfer. He's a twice winner on the European Tour and a brilliant year in 2018. And he won at a very early age the HSBC Wee Wonders and in 2008 the Boys Amateur Championship. A golfer with an enormous amount of talent. And I got to know him during my days working at HSBC, where I realised there was so much more to Eddie Pepperell than just golf. A dry, keen and enormously witty observer of the world around him that he does through podcasts and social media, particularly on the lunacy of life as a professional sportsman. He really is the most excellent company, irreverent, and has been a regular guest on Are You Not Entertained before. And so it's a real joy to welcome Eddie to this show. I can hear his footsteps on the gangplank right now. So let's welcome him to the Captain's Table. Eddie Pepperell, a very warm welcome on board. And thank you for coming on the Captain's Table podcast. And a happy new year. Pull up a chair and make yourself at home.
Thanks, Giles. Pleasure to be here.
It's not your first time on Are You Not Entertained on the podcast series. You've been on twice before. You're like our sort of resident repeat guest.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, as you say, I've been with the other guys a couple of times and that's always been fun. But to, and in fact, the second time I came on, that was when you were there. I didn't, the first time you were not there. So yeah, it's fun.
I get you to myself now. It's great. And did you have a good Christmas? Did you get some time off?
Yeah, last time I played was Dubai, and yeah, we've gone for it. We went for it at Christmas. We thought, you know, Christmas 2020 has been a terrible year, so we are going to go all out, and three households. We really nailed it.
Good. Well, now you're on board the Reeve Gauche. Your beautiful bags, and thank you for not bringing any golf bags. That's appreciated. Are going to be taken into the middle of the boat and by my steward Paul. Can I apologise for the mess on board that you'll see all around you? We had that nasty Andrew Cotter on board a few months ago, and his bloody infernal dogs Olive and Mabel were there, and the boat has not recovered from the chaos. Also, a caveat, this is like rules and regulations. Watch out for my own pets on board who are pretending to be part of the crew. There's John the Parrot, who is not a Norwegian Blue, but he might well be resting. Bruce the Ship's Dog, who's an errant Welsh Labrador who likes to chew head covers, which is why I'm glad your golf clubs haven't come along. And Cat the Cat, who's useless because she is scared of rats. Do you have pets?
I have two dogs, like Andrew Cotter himself. Yeah, ours are probably a bit less well-behaved than his mind.
What are your dogs?
We've got two pointers. One's a Vizsla and one's a GSP. So they're good fun.
Well, next time you come on board, they can come along. They can't destroy things. Well, maybe they can. Then bloody Olive and Mabel. First thing, sorry, this is very remiss of me. I need to get you a drink. Now, as you know, pirates normally drink rum. But for regular listeners of the podcast, this is a slightly classy ship. And the very good folk at Loch Lomond Whiskies provide us, they stock my bar full of their delicious single malt. So, I think you like whiskey. How do you take it, sir? Yeah,
I do like whiskey. Just a small piece of ice is how I like to have it.
And do you like peated or unpeated?
I'm not sure I know the difference yet between those two things, so either or.
I'll tell you what, we're going to get you a glass of both, and you can try them both out. Very good. Right, Eddie, enough of my nonsense. You're on board. We'll sit down. I'm intrigued. You're a top-level sportsman. You work hard at what I think is the most impossible game in the world, a game that I've given up more times than I can care remember. But what was, to get you to that point of being a sportsman, what lit the sport bug for you as a youngster? What's your earliest sporting memory growing up?
Well, I played a lot of football as a kid. And strangely enough, when I got to the age of 12 or 13, I gave football up. And I remember giving up for a pretty distinct reason. And that was that I kind of despised the input from the parents. And I was also playing golf at this point. And I remember also pretty vividly how much I enjoyed just being on my own and being completely and entirely responsible for my own, for the outcomes. And that is something that has certainly stuck with me as I've gotten older and indeed manifested into, things far beyond sport that much more relate to character and ideology even with wider worlds. So it was...
That was a conscious decision, that the sense of team where you could... You had to rely on others versus there was no one else other than you on the golf course. That worked for your psyche, did it?
I think it really did. I was always very individual and I would happily pull myself away from any environment whenever I was unhappy or dismayed at what I was doing. And even if I went on the course with three friends, if I was playing really bad through nine holes, I'd come off and I'd just practice on my own. And I was more than happy to do that. So that's always seemingly been a characteristic and a trait of mine. And I suppose it was no surprise that I quit team sports at the age of 12 or 13 and moved on to what is probably one of the most selfish endeavours you can undertake in golf as a sportsman.
Well, it's not the way I play it because I'm always on other people's fairways apologising. But so that's you as a sportsman, as a competitor. But how about as a fan? You played football probably to quite a good level until you shifted to golf. Are you still, or are you a fan of team sports or general sports, or is sort of golf your everything?
I think what I discovered a few years ago, I discovered this the year Leicester won the Premier League, because I've always historically been a Chelsea football fan. Uh-huh. And I was until Leicester beat them en route to winning the Premier League. And I realised that I would win. And I thought, I'm not much of a Chelsea fan at all. Instead, I'm just a fan of stories. And since that day, I have had, frankly, no interest in football. I have very little interest in any sport. I just seemingly am interested in individuals or stories, whether it's even stories of companies or whatever it might be. You know, if there's an attractive story there or an interesting backstory, I find that much more fascinating and illuminating, as opposed to, I'm very untribal. In fact, I think I don't try to do this consciously, although I think at times it's wise for us all to do it. But I've realized, again in the last few years, just how untribal I am in that sense. And I think it's part of the reason why I've never gravitated towards being a hardcore fan of any particular team.
But do you love, that's really interesting. So you love sport, but what you love about sport, and that can include the action, whether it's a football or rugby or cricket, but it's actually the narratives around the people and where they've, the triumph, the highs and lows, that's what compels you to follow?
I think so. But although I don't follow, I don't follow anything in the sporting world. But yeah, if I do watch it, if I am immersed or involved at any point, then I am gravitating towards the, those people who just have some kind of, something else going on. And I find that much more illuminating.
So do you like sport? Do you like the kind of sports movies where it's kind of, the coach who triumphs against you know, racial prejudice in the community. I mean, do you like that kind of narrative where the sport is there's narrative of the sport? Does that float your boat?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to my mind is Coach Carter, when you just mentioned that. And obviously I enjoyed that film, probably because it had Samuel L. Jackson in, and I like Deep Blue Sea as well.
Did you like Deep Blue Sea? That's interesting. That's interesting. You're the only person I think that maybe
I'm ever petrified of sharks. it's tricky, really, Jar. This is going to probably be a difficult podcast for you because I'm not really much of a fan of anything apart from chocolate, wine, and dogs. And
oh no, we're fine. We're fine. We can go straight to the whole nut. I promise you, anytime. I find that interesting. So you are then surrounded by the sporting world that the golf circus operates within, and you have great sportsmen, in your case, around you who play their game. Do you take that view, that 35,000 view on that industry as well, even though it happens to be the one that you're making your money from, and look at your fellow golfers and see them as more narrators of their own stories? Is that what makes it interesting to you? Or do you tend to distance yourself from a lot of them? How do you operate within that sphere then?
I think as I've gotten a bit older and more comfortable out here, I haven't bumped into anybody yet that I've been in awe of. And I say that not to... in no way, I don't say that with an arrogant slant in the sense that I am of their level or they aren't superior to me, because quite frankly, they almost always are better than me. But it's more in the sense that I've struggled with this for a number of years, this sense of weighing up in sport and in life just how important is something. You know, treading the line of between apathy and importance is something that I've struggled with a bit in my life. And I sometimes find it difficult to appreciate the magnitude of any situation, because quite often I will just take the apathetic stance. And so for that reason, I've never felt in awe of any individual. And even when I've bumped into Tiger Woods or when I played with Phil Mickelson, I fully respect and admire their achievements as golf people. But as individuals, I've always found it, I've never been too in awe of anyone. I don't know. Yeah, that's
interesting. That's interesting. No, it does, and it comes through in the way that a lot of how you conduct yourself on social media and interviews. And I've known you for a little while. This transition that I think, because you are a very much the thinking man's golfer anyway. Did you have heroes when you were a little boy who were either golfers or footballers before this kind of sense of, well, maybe I'm not as interested, I'm not the fan I thought, but were there posters on the little Eddie Pepperell's bedroom wall of golfers or cricketers or whatever it may be, or not really, even then?
No, there never was. I mean, my favourite golfer was Sergio Garcia, which in the time of Tiger is interesting. Maybe that shows that I was a supporter of the underdog. But I really appreciated and liked his flair. But the only other sportsman that's come close for me was Roger Federer. But, you know, even up to a point, I didn't feel any, you know, I was never any desire to want to get an autograph, shall we say. You know, I'm one of those people that I would never ask for an autograph, because I just would not really, a day later, I wouldn't even care about it. So, it's just the way
Presumably this is very, I'm fascinated by this. I would imagine that this, it's not an attitude, it's your frame of mind, is very helpful to you, that you're not in awe. One of the questions I'm going to ask you later, but I won't now, was about, you know, you're a golf pro and you get, I think, one of the greatest privileges of being a golf professional, I would imagine, is that you get to play in pro-ams where you're playing with some of the great and the good, whether it be from the world of business, it might be entertainment, it might be whatever it may be. It could be presidents or prime ministers or whatever, because you know how to hit a driver straight and you're a professional. And I don't think a lot of the pros necessarily realize how lucky they are that you get to see people from all walks of life. And I wondered, when you've been a golf pro, that have you been in awe of anybody else, not because they were a golfer, but because they were someone of different standing that you thought, Christ, I hope I can get this one straight off the tee, because this one used to be, I don't know, governor of South Georgia or something.
Yeah, no, this is so funny you bring this up, because this happens every year and a number of times. So I think back to the pro-am I played in Abu Dhabi at the beginning of 2020 maybe, or 2019. I played with the CFO of Emirates, and I played with, funny enough, the chairman of HSBC actually. And I, you know, those two things co-aligned nicely with my interests, which are usually, they're much more to do with economics and things like this. So I was just interested in talking to them about business and, you know, trying to learn little bits. And they were not at all interested in that. And they just wanted to know about golf. And this happens every year at the Dunhill Links. You know, I play with David Walsh. In fact, I requested to play with David Walsh one year, the journalist, because, you know, to spend 3 days with somebody like that is, I think, is such a great opportunity. And I much, much prefer, and I think the European Tour even know this, quite often they put me with business people because I think they know that I'm probably likely to be a bit more upbeat and less sad on the golf course during a pro-am, because I find them generally interminable. But if I've got company that I'm, you know, business people, I find it much more interesting. And that's what pro-ams are, like you say, are really, really good for. I'm far more interested in the business people types than the sports people types, I must say.
And so you wouldn't go to, you know, when you go on tour and you travel around the world, you wouldn't you lads tend to get Monday and Tuesday off, I think, from memory, from my days on the tour and my sponsorship days. You wouldn't find yourself wanting to go to a sporting event in a locality particularly. It wouldn't interest you. So then my question is, because you are someone who's quizzical and you're someone that has got a broader mind than most, I've often thought that the life of a golf professional can be interminable as you're traveling in your suit with your suitcases all over the world. How does Eddie Pepperell break the monotony and boredom of doing other things? And can you?
I don't do a great deal of things, I must say. I'll watch hours of nothing TV. I'll put CNBC and Bloomberg on, which will sound utterly depressing to most people, but I'll listen to that for a leisure, just go by for hours, and I'll just be on my phone, or I might read a book, or I might read articles. And before I know it, time has kind of gone by, and it's dinner time in usual times. Once you reach 6, 7 p.m., then you look forward to going out and socializing for a few hours, and then you're off to bed.
And would you go out, or would you have room service?
I always go out. That is something that I've definitely over the last few years. This is, I think, one thing I've found so difficult about this year from my perspective. A few years ago, probably 2017, I started to go out a lot more, socialize a bit more, and drink a bit more with dinner, and have much more sociable fun during my weeks at a tournament. And that made tour life so much more enjoyable for me personally. It's much more in tune with my nature to be around dinner, to share a bottle of wine with three or four people that I find I can have a pretty stimulating debate with. And this year, because that's been entirely eradicated, that opportunity, I found that very, very challenging. And I think that's why I've hated tour life so much. Some guys are just, you know, can deal with that, but I've struggled with it. So, I would always go out and that.
And would that be like, might be two or three of you, caddies, players, whatever, and go and find a decent local restaurant and just kick back a bit? Is that how you like to do it if you can?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And who are your mates on tour? I mean, what are the golfers that our listeners would have heard of? Who are the ones that you sort of gravitate towards, presumably for humour and that company?
Yeah, so I'm close to a guy called Laurie Cantor. He's had a good year this year, actually. I think this is the first year he's broke through, but... I'm good friends with him. You know, he is somebody that me and him have lots of things that we agree and disagree on. He's great at playing devil's advocate. He's privately educated, so he has a much more rounded sense of perspective than I do. And he's perfect, you know. So often we'll eat together, and there'll, you know, often be two or three others as well. But they could be a bit more random. Tom Lewis, I eat with a fair bit. But I don't eat with a great vast array of people. Having said that, I get on well with everyone that I think I could, but
presumably in a sport, as you see, you talked about it, golf has to be the most lonely sport in the world in terms of just that, you know, you're playing for yourself, but so there's that, and then it can be very lonely when things aren't going well. Do you think that there are sort of, there are characters who deal with that kind of singularity of the game by being very much within themselves, and that's how they, the sort of metronomic, what you'd imagine Bjorn Borg was like back in the day before it was all revealed that he was a proper player? Or do you think that there's those who they need, and it sounds like this is what you are, is it, yes, you have to do the metronomic bit, which is play golf and practice on the range, but in order to come back to planet Earth, you need the company of mates on tour just to kind of shake you down and become a normal human being again?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Does golf attract a certain type of character, or do certain characters just fall into the golfing world? I mean, it's clearly going to be a mixture of both. And I know people who, when they come onto tour, they really struggle with tour life. And some people are just a bit more robust and resilient and more happy in their own thoughts. Listen, I think one thing that has to be true if you want to be a successful golf professional is you have to be happy in your own mind. You have to be able to deal with those thoughts, and often they're going to be negative and challenging, because golf is such a soul-destroying sport to play at the highest level. And it's
I can say any level.
Well, yeah, of course. Well, that's true, and that's obviously true. And but just like anything, the higher up the ladder you go, the less forgiving it becomes. And so it requires, you know, it's so humiliating, it's humbling, and we see this really. I don't think it matters who you are, even the very, very best Tiger Woods. You know, they're going to have encounters in their career where they're just they're exposed, and being exposed is the beauty of golf. You know, it's the one thing that being a golf professional for long enough teaches you about life. It's that at some point you feel vulnerable. I've said this before, when you walk on a tee and you feel naked and you feel like everyone's watching you, you feel exposed and vulnerable. But that is something that I ultimately kind of have a sadistic appreciation for, and I know how necessary that is in terms of progression over a course of life, you know.
And do you think when you look back, the sort of the old Eddie Pepperell, and when you're sort of in your 70s and 80s, and you'll look back hopefully on a long career at being a golfer before you try your hand at other things, do you think that that's what golf is really giving you as a professional? Is it's giving you an insight into yourself and also other people about how to conduct and cope with highs and lows? As you say, a lot of lows in golf, it's almost inevitable. Do you think that's what it will be that you'll take to the grave, that kind of sense of self?
I do think so. I just hope that as time goes on, you have to find a way of not becoming in any way bitter, resentful, and instead use it as just as an opportunity, so that when you do hang up the clubs, you can still be influential and effective in the world despite being beaten up, you know, because this is the challenge, isn't it? As you grow old, I think, and it probably relates more to our nature than we'd probably want to accept, but you have to find, you know, ultimately you want to be effective and influential in the world. And I think we as golfers have the opportunity that when we retire, we're going to have enough baggage in the psychological sense to be very, very effective at communicating how to best move forward. But you have to have the passion and the, you know, you have to be feel invigorated enough still to do that, to want to do that. So I honestly don't know where my future lies, but I think I would have to, when I do hang up the clubs, when I do finish, have to find a way of choosing to give back to people, probably young people instead, actually, and using what I've learned to give back to them. I think that would be a nicer place for me.
Have you seen, and are there any of the older golfers, the more senior golfers, who you've seen who've utilized that kind of life experience of being on the tour, who you've kind of admired, not so much for what they did on the golf course, but how they've applied that? You know, I mean, I'm not individualizing it, but, you know, you look at the Nicklauses and the players and the Arnies and all the rest of it. I mean, they've been ambassadors for the sport, but it appears that some of them, like Greg Norman, they've been ambassadors for something else as well that seems to almost, if it doesn't transcend their golf, it certainly makes them more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're a superstar, it's easy to be an ambassador. But I look at people like Paul Laurie, who I think is a great ambassador, is doing really wonderful things for junior golf and in Scotland. And there's someone who's obviously a major winner and has a tremendous career, but isn't someone you would, you know, obviously put in the realms of the Nicklauses and et cetera. So I think people like him are the beauty of golf. This is, we may get onto this, but this is my big concern to a degree with the PGA Tour, the most recent PGA Tour, European Tour, kind of the M&A thing. Because, you know, the great thing about people like Paul Laurie is that when the European Tour, the European Tour over the last 20 years has afforded people the economic opportunity to give back in ways that may not be possible in the next 20 years because of emerging of powers, if you like. And the fact that golf has spread its net so far and wide in a financial sense has just allowed for characters like Paul Laurie to spread their altruistic tendencies, which we always should try to do as a society, and let it. And it's a great thing. And you know, people like him, I think, are just a wonderful example.
Well, talking of the Open Championship and the whiskies, the two whiskies that you're currently drinking, and hopefully you'll make a decision about peated and unpeated shortly. But Loch Lomond whiskies are the spirit of the Open Golf Championship, and they sponsor this fabulous podcast too. And I've got a question. How many Open Championships have you played in?
I think I've played in three only.
And what's it like? I mean, I have no idea. What is it like to play at the Open?
Well, actually, I've had three quite diverse experiences, because the first one I played was at St. Andrews. So it's the iconic one. It's the one that everyone wants to play. And I played there in 2015. And actually, for a brief period, tied for the lead during my third round, stood on the 17th tee and then hit the other side of the hotel. I was obviously clearly shitting myself. And then 2018, I did really well at Carnoustie, felt what it was like to be in contention to win an Open, playing with Mickelson on the final day. You know, that was a great, great experience of playing with quite a lot of confidence. And then last year I played at Portrush. So, which for me, wow. Portrush is likely, if it's providing it stays on the rotor, which I think is surely inevitable, it's likely to become a defining Open venue. It was the first time I played the course and I couldn't believe how spectacular it was. So I think Portrush is, you know, as a future as an Open venue, is just going to be incredible. So I felt, you know, I've had three great experiences, to be honest.
And presumably when you see those, the grandstands on 18, I mean, I don't care who you are, first time you see them, that must be awe-inspiring and very scary.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It doesn't get better. You know, that and Augusta, I mean, I haven't played a Ryder Cup. I'm sure the Ryder Cup is probably the very top. But, you know, an Open at St. Andrews, as a Brit, you know, the Open is... It's neck and neck for me with that and Augusta, but I would probably just tip it in the favour of the Open.
That's interesting. And I've been dying to ask you this question because your answer, I suspect, will be different. If you could have your dream golf team, so like a Pro-Am team or an Am-Am team, so you're captain, you've got three other people to play golf with, whoever, anyone, who would it be?
Yeah, this is one of those I've thought about at random times in the past, but the only three that have ever stuck, and these aren't going to be the people you expect, but it would be Stephen Merchant, Ricky Gervais and Carl Pilkington.
Fun.
I spent a number of years growing up just listening over and over to all their material, whether it was on XFM or their podcasts, and I just thoroughly enjoyed it. So, yeah.
That would be a long walk, not at all spoilt, would it? And if you hadn't been a golfer, and you know, obviously you've always intrigued me as a character on the tour, having worked with a lot of golfers in the past, is that you've always been someone who is interested as well as interesting, which is a huge compliment, by the way. Do you have any idea what you might have been, or did you qualify? Were there things that you were looking at? Had golf given it's a precarious route to the top anyway? Are there things that you wish you or could have done or still think you might?
It's almost impossible to say, because I played golf from the age of four and football. So golf and football was all I ever knew. And once I chose golf, golf was all I ever thought I was going to do. And there was never an alternative. And I hated school, and my school were actually very good at allowing me to drop subjects. And they were very accommodative of my desire just to be a golf professional, even though a number of the teachers must have thought he's, you know, cloud cuckoo land or whatever. But So, you know, honestly, I don't know. And it really wasn't until I reached the age of kind of 19, 20 that I then began to start reading. In fact, the first book I ever finished was a Lawrence Dallaglio autobiography when I was on holiday at the age of 19. And something about reading at that point in my life just ignited a kind of a real energy inside and a desire to learn more. So, you know, honestly, golf has always been all I ever wanted to do when I was young and all I ever felt I would do.
So do you think golf, in a sense, what you're saying is reading Lawrence's book? In fact, he came on the show. He's one of the earlier guests earlier in this year. Do you think it's enabled you to become far more interested in the broader world, ironically, by going into the tight world of golf?
Quite possibly. I mean, for me personally, it was definitely reading. It was a reading about another person's experience in Lawrence Dallaglio. And ironically, they were all rugby players at the beginning. Johnny Wilkinson, Martin Johnson. These books kind of, I found there was something about the spirit of a rugby player that I just thought was inspiring and pretty captivating. And that then began to, you know, open up the wider world to me. But I don't think I had that really before that. Having said that, I remember being at an England golf trip when I was pretty young. I want to say 16, 17. And I remember using an analogy to the sports psychologist there, Brian Hemmings, who I always got on great with. And I was struggling. I was struggling, but I felt like I had a lot of potential. And I used an analogy. I said, I feel like I'm well, actually it sounds like Elton John, but I said, I feel like I'm a bit of a candle in the wind. And I just thought I was a flickering candle. That's what I said. I said, I'm flickering. And there's moments of brilliance. And then there's moments where I'm just non-existent. And when I look back, I think actually, if you're a 16-year-old and you can use an analogy like that, then clearly it shows there's an underlying, there's something a little deeper that you're willing to think on a layer that's a little deeper than just the real life action reaction. And so clearly things were in the underbelly when I was relatively young, but only until I got a bit older into my 20s did I begin to explore topics a bit wider.
Well, we now come to the part of the show, my favourite part of the show, which I call the Captain's Broadside, where I ask you a sort of series of relatively quickfire questions, which are sort of more because I'm nosy and are fairly non-sequitur, so just bear with me. So we're on this metaphorical pirate ship. You can see the English oak table in front of you. It's obviously very impressive. But we're free to sail anywhere in the world because it's a pirate ship, and it could even be landlocked. It's a magical pirate ship. Where could I take Eddie Pepperell anywhere in the world on this voyage today and over the next few weeks?
Well, we're not going to be able to get into Australia or New Zealand without a 2-week quarantine, so that's ruled out. where could we go? I think we'll go somewhere that has the natural wild and beauty. So let's go to the Serengeti or somewhere like that.
Down to Africa. All right, that's good. We haven't been there yet, so I'll look forward to that. We've got the menagerie to protect us. And at this beautiful table, I'm going to feed you all the way down to the coast of Africa and then inland into the Serengeti. And what I offer all my guests on the first night is you choose the menu on the first night. So you get a 3-course dinner. I throw in cheese as well. So that's not a course. So you can have any cheese you like. But what is the Eddie Pepperell 3-course dinner?
Well, we're going to go for the diet that me and my girlfriend did this year. So the first course is going to be we're going to start with some liver.
I heard about this. The liver. Right. How are we cooking that?
Well, I hate it, however it's cooked, but it's got to get down here. So we're just going to fry it and then chuck it all in a glass of water and swallow it all. So it won't be an enjoyable first course, but it's good for you, right. Obviously. So then the main course, we're going for a big ribeye steak or preferably a tomahawk.
Sorry, what is a tomahawk? Can you give me the difference?
Tomahawk, I think, is just a ribeye.
Is it bigger?
It's bigger. It's big. It's pretty big. And that's all we're going to eat. We're just going to eat the steak. And then for dessert, we're going to have a cup of bone broth. And just to top it off,
oh my God.
You will have had definitely more delicious meals, but
I think this is what you really want. You really want this, okay? But we don't need any vegetables. That's clearly anathema to this diet, I imagine. Yeah.
No, we don't need any vegetables. They're a waste of time.
Well, are we allowed to drink? I mean, we've got whiskey now, but are we allowed wine with this? This is ghastly. Well,
I think, Yeah, I think we should have a glass of red wine then, or even a glass, or save it for a port with the cheese. The port with the cheese would be my preference then.
Okay, thank God for that. And does the cheese come before or after the bone broth?
It comes during the liver, because it helps the liver taste.
What is this diet called? The pepperal surprise. No,
I think you know the labels. It's called the carnivore diet, but we right. did it a little more broad.
You did drop a shed load of weight. I did see the pictures. So congratulations. Yeah,
I lost about 8 kilos, and I did feel great doing it. So it's not all. It might sound crazy, but there's definitely method behind the madness there.
Well, thankfully, we're giving you a really beautiful ensuite cabin as far away from mine as possible. Given the, I suspect there is some. There's consequence to this diet. But anyway, it's ensuite. And rather impossibly for a 17th, 18th century pirate ship, it comes with a power shower in the bathroom, which is all yours. What song does Eddie Pepperell sing in the shower?
Oh, that's a tricky one, isn't it? I don't ever really listen to music in the shower. So I talk to myself in the shower a lot. So I'm going to be listening to the songs of my mind.
The songs of your mind. Okay, well, and there's some Radox there that might help loosen things up for you. And do you remember what your first album that you ever bought was, or whatever they're called? You're younger than me. Your first, well, I don't know, CD, I guess.
It was probably Westlife. And I'm not at all ashamed to admit that I still love Westlife. Yeah.
Well, that's lovely. And do you remember your first ever live gig that you went to?
I didn't go to, I haven't been to many at all. So live shows, I frankly haven't been to enough, but the one I've been to probably, I've been to this particular show as many times as I've been to any other, and that's the Book of Mormon. So if I had...
Isn't it brilliant? It is hilarious.
I think it's definitely the top three greatest thing on earth, that, yeah.
I've been three times. I genuinely have laughed harder in that show than any other. And Eddie, what was your first ever car?
It was a Vauxhall Corsa.
What colour was it?
It was silver. It was a 1 litre. And my only memory of it was my mum and dad took me for a provisional drive. And we were going up the A34 back from Newbury to Abingdon. And there's quite a steep hill. And I never knew that you could drop it from fifth to third or fourth gear. So I ended up reaching the kind of top of this hill going 30 miles an hour in fifth gear with all the cars behind me beeping me. And as I think back, that's just a terrace. That's an embarrassing thought. And my parents never said to me, Ed, just drop into third. And, you know, because they didn't want to panic me.
And how long did you have the car before it got upgraded? I imagine it was an upgrade.
Yeah, well, I then got another Vauxhall. I got a Vauxhall Astra, an older Astra model. So before, you know, people start judging me and my parents, it was...
And tell me, do you have a hidden talent that people don't know? Like, can you play the harmonica or juggle? Or do you have something random that you can do that people might not know that you could reveal?
No, I'm utterly useless. really am. I'm unimpressive in every sense of the word, really.
Well, it's all right. There's juggling balls and a harmonica in your room. So should you need to feel to while away this time, having spoken to yourself in the shower, you can maybe practice. And this being a pirate ship, I'm obviously designed to smuggle things originally. If we could smuggle your most treasured possession, anything, and then put it safely in a treasure chest and bury it when we get to Africa. Is there something that you kind of hold on to that in your past that you just is something that you'd never let go of? Or are you someone that doesn't really get affected by material things?
No, I'm the opposite of a hoarder. I'll get rid of even my most prized possessions. In fact, I gave away the replica trophy of the Qatar Masters, actually, to a golf club for the juniors to win. But I should say the replica was probably 20 times smaller than the actual trophy. So I think I was so disappointed with the replica it did give away.
Yeah, the real one you could have kept.
Yeah, for sure. The real one would have needed probably I'd have needed to put some support in the house to keep it up. But probably a box of chocolates, Giles, to be honest.
What type? It's a big question, that.
Yeah, well, we're on a ship. We're going to let's go for a pack of After Eights.
Oh, okay. That's nice. I'll probably eat them after dinner if I'm allowed to on this ridiculous diet you're going to put me on. It's quite interesting, you know, that the question about possessions
most of the sports folk that I've had on this show, and I think this, you're the 20th guest, nearly all of you don't have that sense of being possessions orientated. And I wonder, particularly the golfers, if it's because, and the tennis players and all the rest of it, is that one of the things you have to do as a sports person is you have to be able to press delete on the past pretty quickly in order to move forward. Do you think that might be a psychological insight?
I think that's probably pretty accurate, actually, Giles. Yeah, I'd have to say it's not something I've explored that much, but I would, you know, on the face of it, probably agree with that.
That might be the only philosophical thing I've ever thought on this show, so I'm actually quite pleased with myself. So that's a scoop for the 8 listeners. Eddie, listen, I know that you've enjoyed Christmas, New Year. You've got a big year. 2021 is going to be the year when the European Tour, you all start mingling. You're all start going to have dinner together. You're going to start winning trophies. And I remember very clearly that, gosh, a long time ago when you and I properly met in Abu Dhabi and you were on your journey. And it's been wonderful to see your journey, not only because of your exploits and when you're playing well, it's wonderful to see, but I think you bring a candor and a humor to the game that is not always there. And I know that a month or so ago, the great Peter Alice died, who I think was a wonderful narrator and a painter of the game, both as a player back in the day, but also someone who added color. And I long encourage you to carry on being exactly who you are, because I think you bring a lot of humor and joy to people who enjoy the sport. And it's also a great pleasure having you on board on the Reef Goshen at the captain's table. And thank you for doing so. And as mentioned, because this is the Classy Pirate Ship and I'm a classy pirate, the good people at Loch Lomond Single Malt Whiskies are going to give you your own special treasure, which is going to be another bottle of their delicious 12-year-old malt.
Thanks, Charles. That's very nice of them. It's always a pleasure to chat to you.
And all the best. Thank you again for coming on and have a very good season ahead.
Cheers, Charles.
So that was Eddie Pepperell, a man who basically adds colour and humour to the sometimes slightly bland world of professional golf and golfers. For all our listeners, we're so grateful for your support of this show, and we don't want you to leave with your cellars empty either. And so our kind friends at Loch Lomond Whiskies are very kindly, once again, giving away a bottle of a 12-year-old single malt whisky. It's delicious. Christmas rocked this year. To be in with a chance of winning this bottle, head over to their Twitter page at Loch Lomond Malts and follow their instructions to enter. I am still confirming the schedule for the rest of 2021. Slightly too many mince pies, not too organised. But with guests as illustrious as Denise Lewis, Lord Ian Botham, Sir Matthew Pinsent, Sir Gareth Edwards and Brian Habana already confirmed, I promise you that you won't be disappointed. So just keep listening. From all my colleagues at Are You Not Entertained and Loch Lomond Whiskies, thank you for all of the support for the shows we make. We're really grateful for your time. And if you get a chance, please tell your friends about us and get them to find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pod fix by searching Are You Not Entertained. And if you want to follow me or get in touch privately, you can do so on Twitter at GilesMorgan71 or via email at giles@gilesdmorgan.com. So until we meet again, keep your eyes peeled for icebergs, your mizzenmasts trimmed, and your sou'wester in arm's reach in case a squall blows. Goodbye.